Hello, I'm Colin Baker, known to my friends as Old Sixy, the sixth Doctor in that wonderful series Doctor Who. And I am proud to tell you, you are listening to me, and also Gallifrey Public Radio, the radio that brings you everything from Doctor Who to Rhino Wants a Wife, which is a book written by Lucy Baker, my daughter. It's a children's book. You can get it from fbspublishing.co.uk, and it's about a rhinoceros who is lonely and wants a wife, and it's illustrated by my other daughter's boyfriend, and it's a bargain. Buy it!
This is Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up.
Welcome to episode 381 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where it's the end of the world as we know it, so why not fire Owen for good measure? It's the least we can do in these troubling times. I'm Haley.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Kier. This week, the rift opens, the hub collapses, and Cardiff looks like the cover of an 80s heavy metal album as Abaddon stomps out the tune for the Torchwood first season finale, End of Days. It's been a number of episodes.
It certainly has.
No one can say it wasn't.
So we want to make sure that we get our initial right-off-the-cuff hip-shot reactions to what was the unexpected two-parter to close out the first season. Jay, what did you think of what led us to the wide-open rift and everything that comes with it?
I could not remember anything that came with this episode, and after watching it again, now I understand why.
Really?
Okay. I remembered the giant demon, but I didn't remember anything else that had anything to do with it.
Okay, so the catalyst that led up to the Son of the Beast, which I thought was always so interesting because of the fact that they actually connected this with the Satan Pit.
Mm-hmm.
And said that this was the son of the great beast. That always, every time I would go back to this, I would think, oh, really? That's okay. That's his daddy?
Okay. I mean, there was a certain family resemblance there, i.e. using almost the exact same visual assets.
It's true.
They already had the model built and everything.
God, I'm not going to render this thing twice. Just run a sepia tone over it, for crying out loud. Okay, so let's find out exactly. It sounds like the two of you are saying that it was a little anticlimactic for the climax of the first season, perhaps. Is that, am I reading that correctly?
A little bit.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of a fitting end to the first series. You know, it's not the worst, it's not the best. It was an episode.
Okay. Well, let's dive a little deeper and see where the merits are and where the stitches show.
All right, let's do it.
From out of the darkness, he is come.
What is he talking about?
Son of the great beast. Cast out before time, chained in rock, and imprisoned beneath the rift.
What?
All hail Abaddon, the great devourer. Come to feast on life.
There is the aspect, for obvious reasons, because of everything that they have built up to, and this attempt to pull all of the fragments of the season to date together, that everybody's really irritated with one another. Mm-hmm. And not just for the obvious reason of the dangers of pulling Jack and Tosh back through time by futzing around with forbidden rift technology. There seems to be this convenient, well, I say convenient, and I'm sort of letting my cards show here, this aspect of everyone seeing certain visions of things that allow us to tap back into almost the entirety of the rest season writ large, right? Everybody gets these visions. Mm-hmm. Is that that aspect and the whole aspect of everyone just nearly everyone being at each other's throats, or at least just really, really irritated with one another, something that you think makes a valuable contribution to the intensity or the dramatic nature of this sort of a finale? Or did it seem like something done specifically for that intent? Did the writing show, or did the writing serve its purpose?
To me, honestly, it felt kind of like, well, we need something to kind of draw the, you know, start the tension early. Like, I don't feel like it contributed anything to the overall plot. It was a device just to kind of kick things off.
See, I thought it was a good idea. It's a good way to put everybody against Jack and on the same team. This is why everybody wants to open the rift. I just feel like everybody was up at like a 12 the entire episode. And part of it might have been the music was really amped up the whole time. Mm-hmm. The acting was very amped up the whole time. It felt like we needed to breathe every once in a while, and we didn't get a chance to. Almost soap opera levels at a lot of points.
I can see that, and I wondered to a certain degree whether it was justified with certain characters and not with others, so that, and it connects in with another point that I had, which was the fact that Tosh seemed like she kind of drifted into the periphery yet again. If this is really going to be an ensemble show, there has to be a really recognized and effort-driven balance with the contributions of every member of the team, and even to a certain degree, those who are the supporting cast for the team. I feel like we got more from Gwen's previous police constable buddy than we did from Tosh in this one. And yet, she was supposed to be as emotionally invested in this as everyone else. And yet, of all of the things that could have been presented to her, she was just shown a very kind of disjointed vision of her mother.
And I don't think we've had anything with her mother before this episode, have we?
She had one conversation with her in the first opening seconds of the Captain Jack Harkness episode, where she's talking to her mom on the phone. And the only reason why is because she's having a conversation in Japanese, and she gets off the phone and she apologizes to Jack that she had to talk to her mother.
So it seems like there's a missing Tosh episode from the season.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
So if that's the case, going back to your point, Haley, about everybody being at 12 the entire time, where is the justification for everybody being up there?
There wasn't. Like I said, the tension needed to be up that high, and so they just kind of kicked it off and ran with it. Mm. You know, they needed an excuse for Owen to be able to pull the trigger towards the end.
Since it's difficult to determine exactly how much time has passed between any of these stories, it's equally difficult to figure out how fresh the wounds are for any of them. Mm-hmm. So when they have these visions, and so, you know, when Yanto sees his past girlfriend, what was her name? I can't even remember her name now.
Cyber girlfriend.
Right. The cyber woman. And Gwen, I'm sorry, not Gwen, Owen sees his love lost from out of time. You don't really know. Well, Owen, in his particular case, has been carrying this on his sleeve throughout. He won't let this one go, so let's just take that one as written. But each one of them is reacting as if what they just witnessed or experienced is so fresh and so raw with them that it is the consummate reason why. No, we have to open the rift wide. We have. There's no. I feel this viscerally. And it feels like to me the only person that really should is Gwen, because she's being given something present day, something that's valuable to her right now is being threatened.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like that was the only one that really seemed like it packed any kind of punch, you know, with Ian or with Yanto and Owen, it was just kind of like, hey, here's this thing that you lost that you're still kind of broken up about. And it was kind of very, it seemed easy for them to be like, no, this is not what we do. This is not how we, whatever. And then you get to Gwen, who's like, hey, this is going to happen. You have to prevent it. And that has a lot more punch behind it.
Mm. And the fact that it's not even at that point, in some of the other cases, you feel like it could just be, maybe it's Bill is just messing with him. You know, he's just giving them, showing them visions, and just kind of manipulating their minds into making this decision. But with the case of Reese, it's carried out. It's foreshadowing.
Yeah.
And it's brutal. And Eve Miles' reaction and the way that she carries, like, her whole, that whole sequence is gutting. I mean, she can carry distraught really, really, really well. And her, you know, lashing out at Jack and things like that, she absolutely owns that scene. But that's the kind of level where if you want to try to convince me that you're taking this team that has been trained to revere and fear the potential power behind this rift and everything that goes along with it and the reason why these protocols are in place, and then you're going to get them to abandon those, it has to be, the justification has to be that intense. And that seemed like the only one that really met that measure for me personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've been set up since the last episode with Owen. He's already there. He was ready to flip the switch two episodes ago. So we didn't need to see him convinced, but we didn't get the journey for Yanto or for Tosh.
Right.
Yeah, it had everyone had that kind of moment that Gwen did, oh, I absolutely would have bought in. But it's the fact that everybody kind of piggybacked off of her. Like, they're like, oh, we had a thing, but now Gwen's really upset, so we're all on the same. Like, it didn't feel earned.
I would have also liked to see, like, the slow turn of the team abandoning Jack and going to Owen's side.
Yeah.
As opposed to just flipping a switch.
Right, right. Sort of peeling off in onesies, twosies, because that would, at least from an audience perspective, make it feel like the leader is not, it's not a coup, which that's what this seemed to feel like. It seemed to be like a mutiny, whereas it could have been more a matter of just him just standing alone. Each person slowly turns their back on him. And then you realize that, you know, and maybe as an audience member, you look at it and say, well, maybe he isn't the leader that he's claimed to be all along. Maybe it isn't really justified that he's making these decisions, because, you know, they have each come up with their, individually and in their own accord, come up with their reasons for turning their back and saying, no, this is something where we have to, protocols be damned, that this is larger than us.
Yeah, there really could have been a better way to involve the audience, you know, have us begin to question along with the team, or at least have us feel like it's like, okay, no, we're still behind Jack, but we get why everyone's been out of shape.
Mm. So I'm just going to throw this out there because I'm still trying to completely, without like just getting some sort of a wiki summary to try and tell me what they think it is. Who the hell was Belus, really?
A priest of Abaddon?
With this ability to sort of say, you know, when it gets down to the point where Abaddon is finally... I've gotten so accustomed within the Hooniverse to when you get these high priests that go and summon whatever, whether it be some sort of a minor demon, or a creature from another realm or another dimension or existence. Mm-hmm. Typically, when you summon your boss, mm-hmm. you die. It's like
there is a price to be paid for 9th level cleric spells, okay?
Yeah, right. Okay. But you summon them, you're like, "Hey, I warned you, the great one has come," and and he's the first one to meet his demise as an example that what you summoned was so out of control that even the one who brought them around can't contain them. Belus does a peace out and says, "I warned you that this great coming was happening. I just didn't happen to mention that I was the one making it happen. But here it is. I gotta go. I think I left the gas on." And so, for all intents and purposes, when Abaddon is done, this dude's still out there. And he's got tremendous abilities. Now, I'm hoping that they were only manifested through Abaddon, or something of that nature, so that he can't continue to manipulate the way he has and just sort of wink in and wink out of time, because his abilities transcend anything that we have seen with other time travelers.
Yeah, he's not using any sort of tech at all that we can see.
Yeah, nope. He blinks in and out.
Yeah, total I dream a genie, boop, he's out. So
I just pictured him in the costume.
There you go. Yep. You got it. Pink halter top. Yep. It's not pretty.
The bangs work, though.
Well, yeah, that's true. So I just, that one's going to continue to rattle around with me, because I know in a lot of times, especially with things like the comic material and some of the extended novelizations or novel writings, that they like to grab onto these ancillary characters and manipulate them a little bit and just say, oh, you know, there was, even if it's just a name check to say, oh, well, there was the damage that was wrought when, you know, Adam Mitchell rolled through town kind of thing, you know. I'm sorry, I had to use Adam Mitchell reference, but that sort of thing. And as far as I know, I don't think that Belus has ever been used again. And yet he's like almost a trickster level of character as far as his abilities and his desire to make mayhem. I don't know. I'm kind of fascinated by him and the fact that he got such an easy out at the end of this.
I wonder if they originally planned to bring him back, but the show changed so much after the second series that idea was abandoned.
That could be kind of cool. If they had taken a full season break from him and then somewhere in the middle of a more reasonable season 3 or more rational or less painful season 3, that they decided to sort of work him back in along with maybe a couple of other big bads that they had established, and he could have been sort of this legion of supervillains, that would be kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that would have been really fun to, I mean, especially because we talked about this with, I can't even remember her name now, the other Torchwood member who got killed in the first episode.
Susie.
Yeah. You know, we talked about how it would have been fun to have more of a buildup to Susie coming back, you know, like earn that kind of thing or whatever. And I feel like they kind of had that set up with Belus. He could have come back later on and had that kind of like, oh crap, it's this guy again, you know, and all of a sudden the stakes just are automatically at the most extreme.
All right. So I wanted to check with you. I want to remain positive about this episode. I personally do, because there are some things about it that I genuinely enjoy. And I think on the whole, while it is a little rocky at times, it sort of reminds me of if you extrapolated it, kind of speaks for the entire first season. There are a lot of things about it that I really enjoy, and there are a few moments where you kind of watch it through your fingers, not because you're scared or concerned, but because you're a little bit embarrassed that you're watching this, and it is what it is. But when we get through everything that we're handed and we start building to this moment where circumstances are what they are, like Owen drawing a gun on Jack, these scenes are impactful, and in those moments, things are they're justifiable, right? Their anger is justifiable, and the nature of their conflict is one that you can wrap your head around. And even the reactions from other characters in the scenes are on point, and they're all really in it. And then you get to Abaddon stomping through Cardiff, making a big old mess of himself, and you get what I can only refer to as the Shadow Showdown. Take me through your thoughts as you watch scenes like this, where there's only so much you can do with a little tiny Jack Harkness who's, you know, 6 foot one, and Abaddon who's probably about, by six scale, looks like, yeah, like 60 stories tall. Like, how are you gonna do something like that? So does this sort of a climax, is it sufficient? And does it at least give you a sense of, okay, you know what? Everything that we've gone through and everything that we've learned about Jack at this point, I can take that. I can suspend any disbelief and say these are two creatures from two very different realities dueling it out with whatever weaponry they have at hand, which happens to be themselves.
Honestly, the closest I can think of with the scene is the long song.
Mm.
But this doesn't have the score behind it, and it doesn't have the, you know, the awesome powerful speech. It's just John Barrowman screaming like somebody told him that he wasn't allowed to flash his coworkers anymore.
For a long time too. I timed it on the second rewatch this past week. It's at least a minute and 20 seconds of him kind of leaning back, and you know, it's a long sequence.
Yeah.
It doesn't really do anything. It's just, okay, these two creatures sitting there screaming at each other.
I think that's part of
it. It doesn't feel like a battle.
I think that's part of the problem with using Abaddon as the big bad at the end of the series is it's a little cartoonish. I wish they'd had a subtler villain to kind of finish things up. I think it would have played better.
Something that had more of a long arc to it so that you saw the impact or the gravity of the adversary
just the threat of what's going to come through this rift that's open now. You know, we've already got Black Death. What else could come?
Mm.
I don't think we needed a 600 foot tall demon.
So you die in his shadow, which is a very literal take on that, right? You literally die in his shadow. What if you're inside?
That one guy got into a doorway and he still died.
Yeah, but I watched that one in particular because I noticed that dude who was the street cleaner, and he was at least partially in there. You know, there was a little bit of light that was thrown into that little alcove where he ducked in. He wasn't totally protected. But
saying if you're already in the shadow of something else, that the demon shadow shouldn't hurt you, so you should just carry an umbrella all the time?
Precisely, yeah.
There you go. So simple. This is how we fight demons.
What if you're wearing really good sunblock? I don't know. These things still need to be explored. We need to do adequate Abaddon testing.
He wasn't around long enough for us to put together some control groups.
All right. So if that's considered to be the climax moment of the episode, it seems like we are handed all of these little denouement moments that are equally powerful, right? Or intend to be equally powerful. And maybe it's a matter of, as you're watching the season, whatever particularly resonates with you, we're going to throw you a half a dozen things in the final 2 minutes that might be just for you. So you've got the Yanto kiss, right? So that's finally, you know, you stick the landing on that and say, aha, okay. So this is more than a professional working relationship. There's a lot more than just real professional concern and courtesy going on here. There's a fledgling relationship going on, or at least in one of their cases, we don't even know Jack is capable of a relationship, but nonetheless.
Yeah.
But to me, I almost wonder, didn't you want that to be something that was given earlier? Or, because I think the only other indication we got, correct me if I'm wrong, was Owen throwing it in Yanto's face at one point, accusing him of being nothing more than just a coffee boy and a potential on-the-side hookup interest for Jack.
Right, but until Owen said that, there really hadn't been much to give you any indication that that might be going on.
I don't even know if that makes it better, because that means that they're like sort of leading us there by just giving it to us in these sort of forced chunks, rather than giving us some sort of a organic representation of this relationship. like the two of them passing in a corridor and having a quick conversation that suggests that they've had extracurricular activity or something, mm-hmm. you know?
Or was that supposed to be the first kiss?
Wow. I hadn't really thought about that.
It felt like there were two problems. Either it wasn't the first kiss and it does feel like it's just like almost pandering, or it was the first kiss and it should have gotten a little bit more room to breathe.
Yes. Yeah.
I wish a little tension had been built up over the season, like maybe, you know, a scene where they're the last two working in the office at night in a conversation or something, but we weren't given that.
Mm. And I'm always really hesitant about any of these televised relationships that are born out of moments of crisis, because it all goes back to that behavioral psychology aspect of, you know, when people find each other in these in these horrible circumstances, is that all built upon a chemical connection with the stress and the anxiety of what they were experiencing. And at that moment of ultimate alarm and concern, that they are attached to one another because of the shared trauma, versus something that grows out of familiarity and comfort and genuine peace between the two. You know, the idea of meeting one another on an equal level, rather than when everybody is amped up and not exactly thinking or reacting correctly or straight or whatever. So I don't know. It's just as you were saying, Jay, in either case, whichever way that it was actually intended, I'm not sure if that was exactly what I was hoping to see. I'm glad that we got it, because I'm glad where it, but this is hindsight, knowing where it goes. But mm-hmm. it's not, I don't remember, I'm trying to think back to first viewing experience, other than just saying, oh, okay, so Owen was... Maybe there was something more to what Owen was saying. And that was just as far as my mind could take it, because that we were already slamming our way through 10 other things that had to get wrapped up before the credits rolled. Gwen and Reese's resolution seems completely almost lost in the wash at this point. They begin the episode and they're so much in love again and everything is fine. They're never fighting the way they were fighting like cats and dogs at previous points in this season. Right. And then when they realize, when Gwen realizes that she could have lost Reese forever, everything's great. I'll be there for you, baby. Hang tight. I got to wrap up some things at work, and then I'm totally coming home and shagging you.
Right.
but then we've got Jack, and that little moment where we talk about everybody saw something that would have given them the justification to flip the ultimate switch. And what did you see? And he said, I saw nothing, which there was a point where I translated that in a very particular way. And I just want to get both of your takes on that certain statement. Everybody saw, I forget exactly how Gwen phrases it, but it's everybody saw something that they loved, I think, or something that mattered most to them that would have... Is that right? Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact wording of it, but it was they saw someone that, you know, that loved them or something.
And Jack saw nothing. So yet another layer of mystery added to Jack. But it also led me to think to a certain degree that if it's something that Jack in his heart of heart really wants, maybe he wants to be done. You know, it's kind of like a death wish.
Yeah. Yeah, possibly. I mean, that's one way of interpreting it.
It's a bit morbid, but it just kind of, in my mind, it kind of, there's many times where I look at Jack's character and I think about all of the other, there have been a number of literary characters where they talk about the insanity of immortality and the fact that when you get to a certain point, immortality becomes a curse.
Mm-hmm.
Either for watching everyone that you value leave you, or the fact that you reach a point where the boredom and the ennui of being ever present is something that leaves nothing but a desire to just end it all, and there's no ability to, and that becomes this vicious, endless loop. So I'm at this point where when Jack is being prompted about seeing what loves you or what you love, or exactly how the phrase is spun, and he responds with nothing. I'm like, that makes sense. He wants quiet. He wants to be done, which explains why he's always the one to attempt to sacrifice himself. It maybe in some certain to some certain degree, in the hopes that he's wrong, and he can actually cash his chips in. So
yeah.
Is it also possible that he was lying? Because I feel like we're given things in season two that we know what he would have seen.
Well, again, I think that goes along with how you're translating that particular conversation, or how you're interpreting the phrasing of what's being asked. Because I know, yeah, when we start getting into, you know, understanding of, you know, Jack's family and that sort of thing, that you may spin that conversation a little bit differently. But if it's a matter of a desire, maybe that's where that's where I'm headed with it. Maybe I'm just taking this on a really, really dark turn, but but then he's the follow-up question to that is, what could Belus have shown you that would make you decide to do what we decided? And he said something about, I would need a very different doctor. And that's where 75, 85, 95% of the viewers of Torchwood at that point go, oh, I know what you mean with that.
And then for everyone that didn't quite understand that reference, hopefully they understood it after the very next sound cue.
Okay, so the question that I have for you both is, was that handled the way that you wanted? I can think of a dozen different ways that they could have handled those final seconds, either visually, in strictly in audio, something off camera, anything, in the way that it could be handled about what Jack hears, Cody Fingers sees, and chooses to do. When the rest of the team finds him gone. Do you think that this was a satisfactory execution? Or would you have done it a little differently if you had the option, if you were the editor or if you were the producer and you had a say in how that scene was going to play out? Would you do it any differently?
Yeah, I definitely would have done it differently. I don't know exactly how. I wanted to go back and actually watch Series 3 of Doctor Who and figure out, I can't remember exactly how Jack winds up joining them, but trying to, it doesn't make sense in my head from what I remember. So I don't know exactly what the best way to handle that would have been, at least trying to tie it in with what played out. But I don't think that, you know, him hearing the noise and running off and Gwen just not seeing anything at all was the way to do it.
Mm. Maybe having her catch the end of the dematerialization sequence or something, or...
Yeah, I mean, have her, like, you know, it's like there was a police box, like an old police box or something, and, you know, she doesn't necessarily have to solve the mystery, but, you know, have it be something that she can go on to where her craziness has a different flavor than just, I swear he was right here.
Right, right. Or even if it was something that she couldn't articulate, I'm wondering if you could have at least gotten away with the visual of seeing Gwen's face with the light brightening and darkening as if the Fresnel on the top of the TARDIS was winking in and out, and she was just catching the tail end of it and couldn't quite explain what she saw, but just knew that Jack was gone. So you wouldn't even have to change the dialogue. You just had the scene where, you know, where she's witness to something and you're only seeing her in the frame. I don't know. Haley, would you have left it intact, or are you satisfied with the way it was executed? Or
no, I feel like there was a better version of the scene. I don't know exactly what it was, but I feel like there is a better way that it could have been done.
I'll bet they tried a few different things. I wouldn't be surprised if there was extra footage and they had to sit there in the editing room and figure out exactly how much of their hand they wanted to show.
Yeah, I would love to see what get cut.
Yeah.
All in all, how do I feel the first series of Torchwood went?
I think if you were to step back from individual opinions of the installments, what they attempted to do, or what they set out to do, and what they gave us was executed. it's a matter of how much you want to get mired down in the minutiae of each individual story. If you can keep it at a higher elevation and say, I wanted to know that there were people that had serious flaws, that had secrets that they chose to keep from one another individually and in groups, so that you had factions within the team, because that always makes for fascinating drama, that you have villains that are both known and unknown, that you've got story arcs that do not get resolved by season's end, but you don't feel like you've been led down dead-end streets. Like, it's a, you know, why did you even queue this up if you know you're never going to execute this thing? They seem like they wanted to go back and touch on, at least in a couple of instances, go back and tap almost every story, maybe with the exception of our ghost story. But they were very careful to make sure that the characters, in whatever capacity they could, were always cognizant of some of the stuff that they've been through to date, so that you didn't feel like, wow, they got over that really quickly by the next week kind of thing. I think it did that. RTD is a good craftsman when it comes to knowing the larger frame of artwork that he's creating, and the fact that people are going to be looking at all of these different little facets and saying, Gwen shouldn't really be so happy right now because she and Reese have been having it out for 2 weeks on the show, and she's one to carry her baggage quite a bit when she comes to the workplace, so she should not be so chipper. I never really felt quite like that. So in that regard, I think it was executed well. It's just a matter if you really start staring closely at one writer's story versus another, you can say, oh, here's the high, here's the low, clearly here's the low, and so on. So you really have to take it broad strokes.
Yeah, I really like the idea, like the outline that was on the board at the writer's retreat or whatever it was. You know, we're going to have kind of standalone stories throughout the series, and each character is going to have one story that's theirs that really builds them up. And then when we get to the series finale, we're going to pull all those character stories in, and that's going to be what drives us to our final conflict. I think that's a really great idea. I don't know that it was executed quite at the level that I would have hoped, and I felt like we were missing Tosh's piece of that, as we discussed earlier. But the architecture, I think, is fantastic.
We'll have to see. We joked about it last time, but our memory with this show is garbage.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the Doctor Who episodes from the same time, and it's been 15 years, I think. So it's, yeah, it's...
This was the end of Martha season.
Oh, snap.
When they go to the end of the universe or whatever, it's the right before the whole Saxon thing plays out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's, and I haven't watched those episodes, I think, since I first watched Doctor Who. It's been a while. I don't remember.
Okay. So maybe I'll have to wonder, do we call an audible and say, you know what, before we go into season 2, episode 1, we leapfrog back over into Doctor Who and see where Jack went? Or...
I think that's not a terrible idea.
We can either do it as part of our official review and sort of, you know, shoehorn this thing in there, and everybody can just kind of bear with us on this one. It's not the first time we've done something a little unorthodox because it just seemed like a good idea at the time. What could go wrong? Or we could just say it's part of our homework.
I'm fine either way, but I feel like if we're having trouble remembering that, some of our listeners might be in the same boat.
That's true.
So why don't we leave it up to the listener? You know, if you want us to kind of detour off into Doctor Who for a minute, you know, let us know. If you just want to stick straightly to Torchwood, you know, we can just do this on our own time.
There's one other thing that I want to sort of append to that, and it's really kind of relevant as a result of some of the conversations I've had with some folks who have been trying to give us some feedback on our rewatches, but have had some varying degrees of difficulty, specifically because of accessibility. And this is a concern that you would think that right now, with everything that we're going through and with the fact that everybody is scrambling to try and find their entertainment sources as accurately, as readily as they want them, because we're, let's be honest, we're consuming more media than we probably were 3 to 4 months ago. I'm totally guilty of that, and I'm not ashamed of it, but I'm more discerning about it. And my opportunities, if there are a handful of resources that I can tap into that, you know, until we know exactly what is going on between the BBC and HBO, or you know, do I have to live in a certain region for my Netflix to actually carry New Who episodes? Do I have to tap into nefarious resources to try and watch my classics or what have you? Which you don't, by the way. Let's just lay that out there. With Torchwood has always been one where I'm like, I at any given moment, if someone says, "Oh yeah, I caught a few episodes of it along the way, but I don't think I've ever watched the seasons in earnest. Where can I find them?" And I can't, from week to week, I can't tell you. Oh, it's a Hulu. No, it's not Hulu. It's iTunes. No, wait, no, it's not on iTunes right now. And I have to hunt for this stuff. So if anybody's running into difficulty with either going through the rewatches that we've been doing, the classics and the Torchwood specifically right now, or even with something like this potential idea of saying, you know what, let's quick bump over to series 3, right? Series 3 of Doctor Who proper?
Yes, series 3.
And catch up on those. If you're having trouble getting access to them, which I hear not only within our circles, but even when they do something like the global rewatches that they've been doing a number of lately, and people say, well, that's great that you're doing these, but where am I supposed to watch them in my region or what have you? Let us know about that, because I'd love to hear everybody's thoughts on their expectations and their desires about accessibility to the content, specifically right now, given these circumstances, because this fascinates me, especially the fact that we hear from so many people on a global basis that are saying, it's great for you in the US and Canada and UK and so forth, but here in Australia, we're dealing with this, or here in Germany, we only have access to these and so forth. So it's an interesting conversation. I'd love to have it. So please chime in with us on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to keep this short and sweet because this is strictly visual, and it's a lot to process, even in a visual medium like that. So 2 points. Jay, flip a coin. Do you want the one to ponder or the one to sit back and feel the pain in your chest?
Let's go with the first one here. We just recently had the global rewatch of Listen. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of things coming with that, and there has been a little bit of an epilogue tagged on to old Danny Pink's story.
I'm always in team Danny Pink. I always have been.
Oh yeah.
I think it's probably because of the very Brigadier-esque kind of parallels. Yeah. But the idea of having the soldier with a heart always appealed to me, and I always felt that Danny got a bum rap. The weird thing about this particular poem that was written, and then narrated, Richard Ashton did a lovely job of narrating for it, and the illustrations that go along with it that are very that are straight out of our comic talent, and it's a great thing to kind of watch on a panel by panel reenactment, begins with Cyber Danny, which is jarring.
Yeah.
Because listen, Danny Pink, and you know that story, and going back and using that point of seeing a little young Danny Pink and being comforted by the doctor, and there's even the connections to what the doctor was afraid of. We all loved that story when it was first handed to us. You know, it was something that was kind of a fascinating little exercise. I didn't think that they would jump to Cyber Danny as the kickoff. I don't know. That's just weird.
No, but it kind of worked for the story that they were trying to tell.
Yeah. It's brief. It's only like, what, two to three minutes?
It's like 3 minutes. Yeah.
Definitely worth it. And it is not just a little short story. It is literally a poem, by the way, mm-hmm. described. You just have to kind of recognize it as such. And it's really interesting if you accept it and absorb it that way. So I'm really glad that they just shared it today. We're recording here on the 20th, and I love the creativity that they're tapping into for a lot of these lockdown editions that are being handed to us. Sometimes it's video, sometimes it's just strictly storytelling that gets reenacted, sometimes it's a voiceover. It's just, again, goes back to the mm-hmm. this great creative pool that we have around this universe.
Yeah, more content, more.
Yeah, keep it coming.
As far as creativity, even outside of what the professionals, finger quotes, professionals are doing for us, there's what the fan base is doing or has been doing. And oftentimes, at least in this particular instance, something gets created that is a long time in the making because of the complexity of it.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's not necessarily born out of, this was not a quarantine project by any stretch, because it sort of predates that, mm-hmm. it makes you wonder if this was done when we had our, you know, all of our work demands and everything on our time and everything that we had to do, and you can still put together something like this, and we're just going to call this the end game credits for Doctor Who. Imagine what's being worked on right now that we'll see in a couple of months.
Oh, man. I can't wait. It's going to be fantastic.
So there's a video clip out there, and we will share it with you, that has just been making the rounds this week that was assembled based on clips carrying through the close of 2019. So it doesn't really incorporate a lot of series 12's episodes in it, but it's done in the style of the Avengers Endgame credits, closing credits.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's, right in the feels. I mean, anyone that has seen Endgame, like, you know that some of the most emotional stuff to come out of that movie was sitting there and watching the credits.
Right.
Yeah. And seeing the love that was put into, you know, this 10, 12 year, you know, achievement.
Right. So now extend that to 56 years at the point that this was done, and choosing all of the material as far as when each character was being introduced, what little snippets, what little scenes were you going to put behind their name and their visage to say, you know, this was their point in the story. And there's one more thing that I wanted to see if either of you caught, and that was the sequence. Did you notice, you know, we started with companions, and then we worked our way through to modern day, and then we went to the doctors? Mm-hmm. Did you notice the way that worked?
I noticed there were a couple that got pulled out and given the special with so-and-so treatment.
Right. And there's a bit of conversation about whether some of that was justified. How many withs and ands did you have to put in there, and who gets those revered positions? And that's really up to the creator in that particular case. But notice that the companions escalated upward chronologically.
Yeah, and the doctors went backwards.
Back down to Hartnell. Just mm-hmm. really, really classy in the way it was done. And I don't know why it was that the Eighth Doctor got snubbed the way he did.
Because he wasn't technically part of the BBC show proper.
Okay.
He never had an episode that fell in the range of the show.
Okay. I'll take it.
You're going to set Kira off.
I would not have personally made that choice. I mean, he's just as much a doctor as is the War Doctor in my book. But I can see that being the logic behind it.
It is still a great emotional journey. It is definitely worth the couple of minutes of your time to watch and just really appreciate the selection of character moments that each companions as well, as far as just what's going to be the little things where you say, when I picture so-and-so in my head, my mind immediately goes to that scene, and see if it maps to what this particular editor chose to put together. Special kudos to Rory, who is not always my go-to companion on these things. But if I think of Rory, I think of him slowly taking off the Centurion's helmet and showing everything that he's freaking worth. So that's one in particular that stands out in my mind.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
So there you go.
I'm SP from the Starling Tribune, a show about the CW television show Arrow, part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other action-packed geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
Well, next week we're coming back with our game night rotation, and this one's something that we're calling quarantine stunt casting.
Yeah, we've done some stunt casting games before where we've decided, okay, let's suddenly put ourselves in America, or let's do this on the lowest budget possible, or what have you. We're going to do this based on, oh crap, who can I get on a Zoom call? So that's all I'm going to give you. So we're going to get some scenarios, and I will give our players some advance notice so they know who they can think about. But if you were really in a pinch and you had to get somebody to jump in and fill in for a read through or something like that, and you had to put a call out to see who's available in their flat that afternoon, who might be tech savvy enough to be able to figure out how to turn their Yeti on, who would you reach out to? So we'll see how this goes. It should be fun.
Well, this has been episode 381 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, this is the end of the world? Strange, I feel fine.
And this is Kira saying, yeah, Jack versus Abaddon. You know, I haven't seen a battle between light and shadow like that since the last time I saw people stumbling out of a rave club at 7 a.m.
And this is Haley saying, way to put your weight behind it, Gwyn.
We'll see you guys next week.
And I'll see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2020. See you next week.